We have been discussing what we generally call the apostolic message, but that apostolic message is all about the reformation of the church. The position is that really the reformation has never ceased. From the time of Martin Luther forwards, the Lord has been continually working to bring the church to maturity and to position the church in the earth. This process will go on. A whole lot of things have been learned by the church, and the last 100 years was amazing, as in fact were many of the periods before. But we came in the 1990s to the time when the Lord began to reveal the whole concept of apostles and the complete reformation of the church in terms of its apostolic life being restored. This is what we've been talking about the last few weeks. Now, if we are talking reformation, then we are talking serious change. At the time of Martin Luther and the reformers that followed, the church experienced really, really serious changes. And it did change the structure of the church, and it changed attitudes, it changed political boundaries. There was a great deal of upheaval that ultimately led to many things that were so much better in the world. And there are periods when reformation means huge change. Now, there have also been long periods when it's been incremental change, things going on being learned progressively, but there do come periods where huge shifts take place. And we have come to such a period. I'm not suggesting that it's meant to be destructive, but it will bring about huge changes in the structure of the church, our understanding of church government, and the very ways in which churches operate in cities. And we're going to discuss a little bit of this in this lecture. Already in this lecture series, we have been discussing such changes as the restoration of apostles, and apostles once again becoming the primary means of God's government of the church. But this is not the only aspect of God's government. And there are some other things that must change. And so tonight we address what I think is probably one of the core issues to properly understanding the life of the church and the Reformation as we're dealing with it right now. And that subject is the oneness of the body of Christ. Now, just a comment on the term oneness. It doesn't mean anything different to the word unity. And so when we talk about the unity of the body or the oneness of the body, we are speaking about exactly the same thing. And unity is a lovely word. The only trouble with it is it's been used so much for quite a while now that it has lost its power to many people. And so unity came to simply mean having some kind of reasonable relationship with other churches, perhaps an occasional meeting, but it lost any power to mean real oneness. But it's meant to be oneness. And we're going to discuss some aspects of that tonight. I remember when we served, my wife and I, and our kids were very little at the time, but we were in Papua New Guinea for 5 years as missionaries. And we visited many villages up in the highlands and coastal villages as well. And what struck me as really strange in those days, it just seemed unusual, it seemed artificial, it seemed divisive, was this. You would go to visit a village, and some of those large coastal villages might have 2,000 or 3,000 people living in them. They're the kind where very often the houses are built up on, you know, stilts over water, that kind of thing. But just as often they're on land, and sometimes they're inland, and quite sizable villages of, you know, 2,000, 3,000 people. All these houses clustered together. Up in the highlands, the villages were smaller, but again, they were in the groups. Now, these people were basically all relatives. If you came from any particular village, you were basically related to everybody in the village. And these villages had existed, you know, for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years. And so village life was interesting. There was a lot that they owned in common. There were agricultural pursuits and fishing pursuits. There was always a village culture. They had their own village language. had their own dances, they had their own way of going about marriages and the like, but they knew each other well. But when churches came along, and one denomination would start in the village and get some people saved, and then another one would come along and start in a different part of the village, you ended up with Christians living in the villages, sometimes large numbers of Christians, but they met separately. And as Christians, they did not meet together, cooperate together, speak together, and yet everything else in village life had always been communal and they'd been one. That struck me as really strange, to go to a village. I have one right in mind now that we went to in the Riga district of Papua New Guinea, Mortu speakers, you know, Papuans along the coast, and I still remember how strange it felt going, and there I saw the Salvation Army Hall, of which we were a part, but realizing that in this not very large village, oh, there was another church over there and another one over there, but there was absolutely no relationship between these churches. And yet, within that tribal culture, it was the strangest thing in the world to me to see that. And just last Sunday morning, right here in Peace in Rockhampton, we had a visitor, sat right over there with his wife and kids, and they've been missionaries in Vanuatu for the last 16 or 20 years, so they're boys who are older teenage boys, who have mostly grown up in the islands. And this fellow, he actually came forward for prayer on Sunday morning, spoke to me. He had been in the conference I did down, the Lutheran conference where I spoke in Adelaide a few weeks ago. He was there accidentally. He said he wasn't a Lutheran, but there he was. He got my book. He's read my book. He turned up here. They're on holidays. But he, having read my book, The City Gate, he was quite familiar with the concepts I was getting at about the division of the churches in our cities along denominational lines and how little relationship there is. All over the world this is so. And he's seen the same thing in Vanuatu. And it's not just, you know, strange and odd. In its own way, it's wicked. It's quite unbiblical that the church has created this culture of division, of just separateness. Anyway, we're going to address a little bit of that tonight, but I wanted to say this by way of opening the subject. The real apostolic message, the kind of message that a real apostle will bring, anyone anywhere in the world who is a real apostle, I'm not talking about what the Bible or what Paul referred to as so-called super-apostles, people who are kind of big and strong in ministry and they're good with public performance, and so everybody says, oh, you must be an apostle. But no, they're not. So, you know, they're good with outward performance, there's giftedness, but very often it's still very much for many of these people about building their own organization, their own ministry organization, and it's not really about taking the body of Christ in the world to another place as a body. So they may be great ministers, but they're not necessarily apostles. And what I want to make very, very clear, if I haven't already before, is that the real apostolic message, as taught by Christ and as brought by real apostles, and if somebody claims to be an apostle, but they have no sense of this part of the message, they're not an apostle. The real apostolic message is never complete, it's never real, unless central to it is an emphasis on oneness, the oneness of the church, and by extension, the oneness of the leadership of the church. So without an understanding of oneness, of relationships, of love, of unity, you do not really have the grace of being an apostle. That is peculiarly an apostolic emphasis. By peculiarly, I don't mean that other people don't have it and can't preach it, but I do mean that without it, you can't be an apostle.